and he holds us unto himself. And so I just want to say, none of us is deserving. Grace only makes sense if it is undeserved, but it is granted to us by the grace and mercy of God. That's what makes grace grace. And I'm going to claim that for your mother. And I'm going to claim grace to you in thinking through these issues. I hope to give you some assurance and peace. If your mother came to faith in the Lord Jesus Christ and she ever belonged to Christ, she belongs to Christ for eternity. All right. Sometimes questions are very specific. One listener said, what's your opinion on Baylor University allowing the group All Our Neighbors, an LGBTQ plus organization, to host a campus event in opposition to the Turning Point event? She goes on to ask other questions about the Baptist General Convention of Texas. I'm simply going to say this, you know, inviting a group like that on the campus, avowedly pro-LGBTQ, is a moral statement I do not believe any Christian university should make, particularly when they're speaking on their own terms. I mean, there could be a context in which there could be a debate or an exchange that could be justified. But when you have an organization that is pro-LGBTQ, and I mean avidly pro-LGBTQ, holding an event on a campus, I think that's a matter of grave moral significance. And I think it would be unfaithfulness on my part not to answer the question once asked. Okay, last question. This one comes from a 16-year-old young man in Georgia, and I underlined the words young man. That turns out to be really important here. And this young man says he has an earnest question, and it's about some female students delivering a biblical message in a parachurch context for teenagers. And he cites 1 Timothy 2:12, quote, I do not permit a woman to teach or to assume authority over a man. He then says, quote, I've been told growing up that it's okay for women to be Sunday school teachers because they're teaching children, not men. But he goes on to say it appears in this context that this is young women teaching young men of the same age. And so, okay, I get the question. And I think the most important answer I can give is that I think this young man who asked the question kind of answers it rightly by the way he asked the question. And that is that at a certain point, there is a line that is crossed. And let's just say, I think the line's been crossed when you talk about girls delivering a biblical message in a context in which you have young men present. Okay, so I want to go to make this point. I want to go to what this young man says, where he was told growing up. And I love this. I've heard this said many times too. I've been told growing up that it's okay for women to be Sunday school teachers because they're teaching children, not men. Okay. I actually think that's right. I think that's rightly ordered. But that also makes a distinction between boy and man. Okay, so I think that's a necessary distinction. I don't think there's anything wrong with women teaching little boys. I don't. Period. But I think it is not biblical for women to teach men in this context. And at some point, a boy becomes a man. So when is that? I would say in the rightly ordered church, that has to come with the arrival of adolescence. And so I would simply say that at that point, there's a male identity that is very, very clear. And it is at that point, it is really clear in the home, in the school, in the church. You just go down. Most importantly, in the home and in the church, it needs to be men teaching boys. It needs to be men teaching each other. It needs to be males who are in this teaching role. And I think one of the key distinctions here is not just between, say, boy and man. It's not just the distinction between male and female. It's the distinction between what could be, in this parachurch context, giving a word of testimony or delivering a biblical message. And so I do want to say this is not exactly the context of a local church, but that's a part of the awkwardness in all of this. I think the pattern nonetheless should prevail. I know I may get in trouble for this. That's all right. I'll be in trouble. I think the pattern the Lord dictated that is given to us on apostolic authority from the Apostle Paul, 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 2, other passages too that I think are complementary, I think that that should apply to Christian ministry, period. I do think it is very much tied to the role of an elder and biblical exposition. So I am not saying that a woman can't teach algebra. That's just categorically different than a woman doing biblical exposition and biblical teaching in the context of a congregation and in the context in which there are both men and women present. That is not Albert Mohler's rule. I believe that is coming to us on apostolic authority. I do think it's our responsibility to seek to understand it accurately and to hold ourselves and our ministries accountable to it. I really appreciate this young man asking the question. It's a good reminder to us that a lot of life in terms of Christian faithfulness is making the right discernments and understanding how in a context to know, well, this is what we must do here. This is what we must do here. Here are principles that are to apply here and here. Here are distinctions that are made in Scripture, that are now commanded in Scripture, and are to be reflected in our lives, in our families, in our ministries, in a local congregation. Those distinctions turn out to be of tremendous importance. And I'll just say for Christians, this is not just grounded in 1 Timothy 3 or Titus 2. It's grounded in Genesis 1 from the beginning. As always, I appreciate the questions. We'll try to get to more and more in weeks ahead. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on X or Twitter by going to x.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.
Years ahead of the dominant media, FirstAmendmentRadio.com and FirstAmendmentRadio.net.
In today's video, more fraud has been uncovered in the state of Minnesota. This time, Dr. Oz is freezing $91 million in additional Medicaid funds. Also, we now have more information regarding the Supreme Court ruling as Louisiana has paused their primary elections. This has Democrats screaming racism. Let's start with the fraud in Minnesota. Take a look.
The FBI has now raided more than 20 businesses across Minnesota in their investigation into alleged widespread fraud across the state. This comes as Dr. Oz announces that the state of Minnesota is being deferred $91 million in federal Medicaid funding, adding that of that $91 million is tied to 14 service categories highly vulnerable to fraud. But now law enforcement will have a new regional task force to fight widespread fraud. U.S. Assistant Attorney General Colin McDonald making the announcement just moments ago.
The data shows that the need for this new strike force is urgent and undeniable. Healthcare fraud in these districts imposes an enormous and growing burden on American taxpayers as fraudsters exploit programs meant for the poor, needy, elderly, and disabled.
At this point, I think it's safe to say that this is normal business for the state of Minnesota. Every week, there is a new bombshell story about fraud being exposed, uncovered. And now Dr. Oz yet again has to freeze more Medicaid funds. Now, on one side, federal taxpayers are footing the bill on this, so it makes sense why we would pause the checkbook, whether that's Feeding Our Future, autism billing schemes, child care fraud, even real estate fraud. Yeah, when you pause the money, it gives you an opportunity to clean it up. However, the governor, including people who lean left, will say this is retribution. The president's targeting people unfairly. And that the state program says it's been aggressively fighting fraud for years now, and the federal government's not helping. I think the results say the opposite.
Let me walk you through what's happening in Minnesota, because at its core, this is about protecting patients and respecting taxpayers. We've notified Governor Walz and state leaders that CMS is deferring an additional $91 million in federal Medicaid funding. That's not a step we take lightly, but it's a necessary one. Here's the issue. Minnesota state-run programs have raised serious red flags, from the so-called Leering Center scandal to a recent Department of Justice raid tied to child care billing concerns. And don't forget how fraud tourists from other states took advantage of Minnesota's weak enforcement to allegedly use AI to fabricate records and steal another $3.5 million. These aren't isolated problems. They suggest deeper vulnerabilities in how funds may be managed. At CMS, our responsibility is clear. The federal government covers more than half of Medicaid costs, which means we have both the authority and the duty to make sure these dollars are used properly. When something doesn't look right, we investigate. It's our job.
See, in a perfect America, you would hear stories like this all the time in every state. There's fraud in every state, guys. There's no doubt about that. Question is, what is the amount of fraud? To what degree? How many people look the other way? How bad is it? How deep does it run? How long has it been happening? What programs are most vulnerable, right? I mean, all those variables obviously will dictate the outcome. But the bottom line is, in every state, we should have a fraud task force conducting or executing public press conferences to show the American people, and particularly the people who are from that area who are forking over their tax dollars, that, yeah, we're doing our darn best to do the right thing by you and your money. Okay, let's go to the whistleblower. Because Newsmax got an interview with her. Take a look.
The day after the raids took place at 22 different care facilities, including the one behind me here, we sat down with Faye Bernstein. She's a compliance specialist at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. She says she's not aware of anybody being let go or fired from the department as of now in connection with all of this alleged fraud. And she also went into detail about why she thinks this all went on for so long. What's your initial reaction to the raids that took place?
It tells us that Nick Shirley is right. And then my next thought is just, and I think the general public says this too, is, so when is there going to be accountability for this? When is somebody going to get fired? Either people knew and looked the other way, which is, I think, a fireable offense, or they didn't know, which means they were completely unqualified for their job, and that's a fireable offense.
All right. If you guys are enjoying the videos here and our show overall, please do not forget to hit that like button, share the show, and subscribe to our channel. Thank you for watching today. You see, let's go back to the very basic principle of our society. There will always be trade-offs. So what is the trade-off here? Well, short-term pain and disruption for Minnesota hospitals versus long-term integrity of a program where roughly half of the dollars are federal. If you can't verify the bill, you don't pay the bill. It's really that simple. And that's not retribution. That's not racism. That's not Hitler or Nazi. That's exactly what Democrats would have the country believe. No, this is exactly what you would do if someone was committing fraud in your own bank account. You would shut that account down. No doubt about it. Okay, one more for you here. Which is a stunning detail. So Tim Walz, the governor, shut down the actual unit that was in charge of rooting out fraud in that state. Take a look.
This is a big deal. One soundbite that really caught my ear. 90 kids you supposedly have that you're billing for that didn't even exist. And Rich, you interviewed his colleague, Scott Stillman, exclusively last month. Now that both have spoken out with damning accounts, what does this mean for Minnesota officials?
Well, I think it lays a baseline. You know, these are two extremely credible people, right? Longtime investigators, both of them. And they're saying the same thing. They're corroborating each other's stories and saying, listen, we found this fraud as early as 2013 up through 2019. We sounded the alarm. Ultimately, Jay Swanson says that when he pressed further, they ultimately shut down. So it was the Walz's administration, DHS, that shut down this fraud detection unit, which is the most alarming thing. So this will prevent these politicians from being able to say, we didn't know about this.
Now, the governor calls this a retribution campaign. And you know what? He's right. We should use retribution against these fraudsters. They've ripped off America long enough. They ripped off people in need long enough. And they've gamed the system. Yes, I think retribution is overdue for people like that. I think that's a fair statement. Okay, why don't we hear from actual Americans? Because they were able to chime in on this. Watch.
What do you think about the fact that this welfare fraud situation in Minnesota is making national headlines?
I think it's really important. It needs to be exposed.
I think it not only needs to be exposed, but we need to have accountability. Because if it's happening there, then it's probably happening in lots of other blue states.
Do you think the Trump administration deserves some credit for bringing this issue up to national attention?
Well, I don't think we'd have any exposure of what we've been witnessing or not seeing, you know, for decades. I thank God for Trump because he's exposed so much of what we haven't seen.
I'm not faulting them, you know, for bringing it. I mean, yeah, those are the kind of issues that need to be brought to the forefront, you know, whether it's local government doing it or federal government. But, yeah, I don't look at it as anything terrible. I mean, it's a good thing.
It's absolutely a good thing, and that's something that we should continue to demand from our elected representatives. Now, let's go to our next update. This is circling back on the Supreme Court ruling that has led Louisiana to suspend congressional primaries after the Supreme Court redistricting ruling. Now, the way we're going to break this story down is using this tool called Ground News. Check it out for yourself, Ground cnn.news/DeVore. This is the tool you use if you want to get the full picture of what's being reported by the media, whether it's left-leaning, right-leaning, whether it's stories that may be identified as blind spots, meaning these are stories that are only being reported by one side of the political spectrum. You get the bottom line, you get all the information you need, and you get to see both sides so you can make up your own mind and come to your own conclusions. And that's needed now more than ever because of how noisy it is on social media. So guys, check out Ground News for yourself. I think you guys will find much value in it. We use it here on the show. So use this for yourself. All you have to do is hit the link in the description below or scan the QR code you see here on the screen, and you're going to be able to get 40% off the Vantage plan. Now, I don't think we are surprised by this announcement, by the way. As you guys can see these bullet points here, Governor Jeff Landry suspended Louisiana's May 16th U.S. House primaries via executive order. This is after the Supreme Court ruling. And the interesting part about all this is the reactions that are already rolling in, particularly Democrats, because not only are they saying that the Supreme Court is now, you know, it's the Trump court and they are illegitimate, but now they're saying this is a racist move. Let's go to some of these clips now. Take a look.
Louisiana's top elected officials say the state's congressional primaries will not be going forward as scheduled in May. This follows yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court ruling striking down a majority black congressional district there. Republican Governor Jeff Landry and Attorney General Liz Murrell say that means the state is prohibited from holding elections under its current U.S. House districts. Early voting had been scheduled to begin Saturday in advance of the May 16th election.
Again, the pushback will be that the Trump administration is making it hard for women to vote. It's making it harder for trans people to vote, for black and brown people to vote. And the bottom line to it is most people don't even understand the ruling. They don't even understand the law. This ruling has nothing to do with someone's right when it comes to voting, the actual act of voting. This has nothing to do with that. This has everything to do with what maps and how they're drawn and how many districts will exist in the state of Louisiana and ensuring that these maps are not based on racial ideals, if that makes sense. So, again, why don't we go to the meltdown? This is on MS Now earlier today. Take a look.
So first of all, I'm just going to express my rage at this decision. And then the second thing we need to do, of course, is to get about the hard work of trying to salvage this democracy as we've done since the moment we've been on these shores.
That is still with me. That happened 24 hours ago around this table. That was our friend Eddie Glaude's profound response to yesterday's Supreme Court ruling in which they dealt a crippling blow, essentially dismantling the Voting Rights Act and its decades-long protections against racial discrimination. That today is already having consequences. Should not be off the news just yet because it's already damaging our democracy.
And if you were to ask her, okay, what about our democracy is going to fail because of this ruling? They can't tell you. They'll make it up, actually. It's just like the statement that my rights are being taken away by the president. Okay, tell me which right exactly. They can't tell you that either. And then when you ask them, okay, in what way is it being stripped from you? They can't tell you that either. It's just so fascinating that these people ignore the U.S. Constitution when it's convenient for them. And then in the name of the U.S. Constitution, they say that they're seeking to protect. They're willing to do anti-democratic things, like draw congressional maps based on somebody's skin color. What about Asians? Do they need more representation? Do we need more representation for people that are from India? I mean, we could play this game all day long. That's why we have to look at things from a neutral point of view and be colorblind about this process, because we're governing the masses. Okay. Let's go to this clip. Watch this.
I can tell you, wow, as a black woman, that my father was born in 1949. He remembers segregated schools. He remembers segregated water fountains. He remembers that he did not have full civil rights. And he told me when I turned 40 years old that I was the first person in his family to enjoy full civil rights. And he is still alive today, and I am still alive today, and I have been discriminated against. And now I have to tell my children that they have less civil rights than I did when I was born.
That's true.
That is disgusting, despicable, and I am devastated by this particular Supreme Court decision, even though, Whoopi, we did know this was coming.
I mean, all you could do is just laugh at these people. Okay, so her kids have less civil rights than she did when she was born. And again, tell me, which civil right do you believe is gone now? Please tell me. Which one exactly? Are you saying that you're not able to vote? Because that's not true. Are you not saying you will have, or are you saying that you're not going to be able to vote for who you want to? That's not true either. So again, they can't tell you the exact civil right. And of course, the president's going to smell blood in the water. So he's reached out to the governor of Tennessee, and they're now moving to gerrymander that state as well. And I've told you guys already, I don't support any of this. I don't wish the president had did this. I don't think gerrymandering is the ultimate solution. It's a short-term one, of course, but there's going to be long-standing consequences as a result because Congress has refused to do the right thing, which is to ban it outright. And so both sides are going to use this to their advantage.
All right, so big ruling, Kevin.
Huge ruling. But imagine a country where your government decides your political voice based upon your race. That's exactly what the Constitution was designed to prevent. You don't achieve fairness by dividing people. You achieve it by treating them the same. That's what the Supreme Court said. It stood up for the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment doesn't promise equal outcome, it promises equal treatment. We're going to see now, because of this decision, not just redistricting in Congress, where you really want to look is all the city council races, all the board of supervisor races that have been predetermined and divide people over race instead of drawing districts about community. This is where everybody lives. This is where everybody belongs. Everybody's treated equal. You're not being picked by the color of your skin. You're being selected by the community in which you live.
As I continue to explain to you guys that the progressives who've hijacked the Democrat Party, they believe they can control outcomes. They can legislate outcomes. They could be the people who say what is the right outcome, what is the bad outcome, but they're not the people who are willing to take any responsibility when it goes bad. And the problem here is if I do not have the power to dictate your value as a human being, why do they believe they have the power to legislate outcomes exactly? It doesn't make any sense. Okay, let's go to Representative Wesley Hunt from the great state of Texas because he was asked about this ruling, and I thought his answer was spot on. Take a listen.
There's been a lot of talk how there won't be any black Republican members in the new term.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
Nothing. I don't understand how that's relevant.
But is it a problem with recruitment? Or
I don't think it's a problem with anything. I'm not here because I'm black. I am here because I'm qualified representative for Congressional District 38, and the American people choose who they want to choose. Yeah. And the one thing I don't want to get into is this game of race bait all day, every day. Yeah. If there's four, if there's 10, if there's none, what we are talking about is who is the best person that is best qualified to fill a seat regardless of the way that they look. And I tell people this all the time till I'm blue in the face. I represent a white majority district that President Trump would have won by over 20 points, and I won by 25 points the last time I ran. I'm being judged not by the color of my skin, but by the content of my character. I don't care how many black people are here. I want the most qualified people that are here.
And
thank you.
Oh, got it. Thank you, Harrison.
You see, it just doesn't make any sense. If you have overwhelmingly white districts electing black people, then how is the Voting Rights Act being modified? By the way, the Supreme Court didn't throw it in the trash. They only modified a certain part of it and called it unconstitutional. How is that racist exactly? Okay, let's move on, because I think this next story explains why these people are so lost. So in Michigan, they are now removing these crime watch signs in their communities because they want to be more inclusive and welcoming, and they think this is going to be the solution to bringing crime down. Take a look.
They are removing over 600 crime watch signs in neighborhoods where there's a lot of crime because they don't think that it's inclusive enough for the criminals.
Basically, neighborhood watch signs are expressions of exclusion, and they're inconsistent with our values. Ann Arbor is a welcoming community. We don't want to push people away. We want to welcome folks in.
You know, there are people that look like me and also my community that have been questioned, quite frankly, in their own neighborhood by others, you know, wondering what they're doing here. I mean, this is just representative of our values and how we want people to feel in Ann Arbor.
Yeah. You know, we don't want criminals knowing that we're keeping an eye on criminals in crime-laden neighborhoods. That woman, by the way, a Democrat.
I mean, let's just take a moment here and think about what's happening here. They are creating policies based on the way that people feel, not based on results that are tangible, that we can measure, that proves progress is being made in a positive way. No, they want to focus on how people feel. I'm telling you, we have a disease in this country where feelings come first, then logic or common sense or anything else that would actually keep us safe. I mean, why don't you guys let me know in the comment section, do you believe yourself that removing crime watch signs would reduce crime in a community? Please, I'd love to know.
Maybe they should take down the gun-free zone signs outside of schools.
I think that would be good. That'd be a good start. But, you know, I'm on in Ann Arbor every night. Carl, I think you know, mm-hmm. I was a TV news anchor for 8 years in Michigan. I love Michigan. I've got a house in Michigan, pay taxes in Michigan, and they are just freaking nuts. They've gone crazy. When you're taking out the neighborhood watch sign, so you want to be welcoming community to who? Who are we watching out for? The criminals, the bad guys, the rapists, the bank robbers. You're all welcome now. Let's say neighborhood watch literally says, we're watching out to make sure you don't do something bad in our neighborhoods. This now says what? We welcome all the bad stuff? Mm-hmm. I don't get it. And you're right. Every single school should say, we will shoot and kill you if you try to take out somebody innocent inside this building, instead of the gun-free zone stuff.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to work very well.
Yep.
So we know exactly where this is going to lead, which is going to be disastrous results, more crime. And it's the MO of these people who tried to legislate with empathy versus governing in regards to the masses and what's actually going to keep people safe. There's no data to indicate that removing these signs would actually reduce crime. But there is data or data points that one could use to figure out what would reduce crime in a particular community. And we have a great deal of history showing that. In today's video, J.B. Pritzker just got some bad news as his policy has led to another fatal outcome in the city of Chicago. Also, Democrats are screaming racism after the Supreme Court ruling yesterday, and students in the Chicago public school system will be protesting on Friday against the Trump administration. Let's start with what happened with this policy from J.B. Pritzker and how it became so fatal. Take a look.
A detention hearing is happening today for the man accused of killing a Chicago police officer at a hospital and critically wounding another officer. He is charged with murder and attempted murder. News Nation's Nick Smith explains why this case is renewing that national debate over cashless bail.
26-year-old Alfonso Talley was out on pretrial release for another crime when he was arrested, and some say if the judge had not granted him cashless bail, these officers would not have been shot. Police say Alfonso Talley has a long rap sheet going back to 2017. During today's hearing, prosecutors are expected to share details about this weekend's deadly hospital shooting. Talley's attorney is expected to offer what he says are mitigating circumstances. This is the officer Talley is accused of killing, 38-year-old Chicago police officer John Bartholomew, and a second officer, 57 years old and a 21-year veteran of the force, remains in critical condition after prosecutors say Talley shot him in the face. Talley was at the hospital after being arrested for robbery because police say he told them he had swallowed drugs. Police say he shot the officers when they removed his handcuffs for a CT scan. The case is fueling debate over Illinois' cashless bail system called the Safety Act. Critics saying it lets criminals out. Supporters saying it gives judges the flexibility that they need.
So where do we start as it pertains to this particular story? We start with the facts that Democrats who are in charge of public safety continue to sign off on policies that do the opposite. The governor back in 2021 signed this Safety Act, which is a very unique name, given that it's actually done the opposite, because he has created a system where judges now get to decide, are we going to keep this person in jail or are we going to let them go? And to let them go is the easy thing to do. The hard thing to do, according to the system that the governor set up, would be to keep someone who's a repeat offender for violent offenses, by the way, locked up in the jail. And as they had failed to do so because of this judge, it led to the killing of this police officer. Now, I want to go to the governor because, of course, he acts like everything is going according to plan. Take a look.
It's one of the great things about the Safety Act is we give the judges the ability to say, no, you're not going to get bail. You are going to stay in jail. And that is something. And also to make the decision that someone who's committed a nonviolent offense doesn't have to come up with the $500 or $1,000 or $5,000 that they might have otherwise had to get bail.
Now, the easy thing to say here is that the Safety Act killed a cop. But the smart thing to say is when you build a system that treats detention as a last resort instead of a tool, you will get exactly the outcomes that the system is designed to produce. The judge in this matter definitely gets the blame, but the person behind all this is the governor because he's giving these judges too many options. There should never be an option on the table that says if someone committed a violent offense, not once, but a few times, and they're awaiting a trial for a new offense, there's no way they would get out of the jail. I don't care how much they're worth. I don't care if they're not worth anything. That has nothing to do with it. They are a flight risk. There's no reason they're on the street. To give that option to the judge is beyond me. But again, this is the way that they like to govern. They want to make things about outcomes. And when they do that, they make fatal decisions. Let's go to the Cook County State's attorney. Here's what she had to say.
Once again, we are reminded of what it means to take the oath to protect and serve. Officer Bartholomew took that oath and he gave his life for the city. Electronic monitoring is not an alternative to detention. It does not keep people safe. When the state's attorney's office asks for detention, we ask for detention because we believe that person presents a danger to the public. If we're not asking for detention, I don't care if they are monitored or not. They can go about their lives and get ready for trial. But if we ask for detention, we make sure that we put every bit of information in front of a judge to establish why we believe this person presents a danger. As we did in this case, we established that he had 4 pending violent felonies, and in spite of that, he was placed on electronic monitoring. Electronic monitoring system is broken. It does not work. It is not keeping people safe. So the state's attorney's office is going to continue to ask for detention each and every time we believe someone presents a danger.
Yeah, you see, these are the type of policies that are impacting everyday Americans. There's so much that people are complaining about on social media and not focusing on the damage that's being done within their own community, like a policy that we're talking about right now. You see, it's in the governor's point of view, it's about wealth-based detention policies. If a person has no dollar to their name, we should give them a chance to get back on the streets because they're not going to afford to make bail. Really? So is that more important than the idea that they're a violent threat to public safety? Which one's more important? In fact, that maybe that's not even the best question. Here's the better question. What is the number one responsibility of elected representatives? To keep the public safe.
At the time of the shooting, Talley, a 7-time convicted felon, was wearing an electronic monitor while awaiting trial for a 2025 carjacking. And according to court records, by March, Talley stopped coming to court and his ankle monitor has stopped transmitting. Law enforcement and some city and state officials are questioning the judge's release decision and calling for changes to the safety system. A second person is also facing criminal charges in this case. According to prosecutors, Talley's girlfriend purchased the gun Talley allegedly used in that shooting.
Okay, let's take a moment because I want to tell you about my friends at Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF is a Christian legal ministry dedicated to advancing free speech, religious freedom, the sanctity of life, parental rights, and God's design for marriage and family. What does this really mean? Well, they've scored huge legal victories like helping to topple Roe versus Wade and securing a landmark free speech win at the Supreme Court on behalf of graphic designer Lori Smith. And you know what else they're fighting? Some of our culture's most pressing issues, from the protection of women's sports to stopping mail order abortion drugs. Yes, this is serious stuff. That's why ADF relies on the generous support of people like you and me to protect freedom in the courtroom and the culture. And the way this all happens is that every dollar you give to ADF will be matched. That means $25 can become $50, $50 becomes $100 only while they're matching funds less. So what do you have to do? Go to joinadf.com/darkens or text darkens to 838 888-888-848 to have your gift to ADF matched. Again, the link is in the description below, or you can text Darkens to 838-48 to ADF. But when you have the Democratic state's attorney breaking with the system, contradicting the governor, then you have the governor essentially blaming the judge, and then you have the mayor who wants to blame everything except the actual policy, there's a true disconnect here. And there's no doubt that the legislator in Illinois has already produced bills to change this stuff, but you know it's going nowhere because this is a Democrat-run state. Now, let's go to the mayor, because his excuse, I don't think it will leave you shocked, but take a listen.
A system that we are still working to repair. It's been broken for a very long time. You know, incidents like this challenge us to look closer into how we can have a system that works justly. And so it has to work both ways. And I'll just be very frank with you all. Look, we've had an addiction on jails and incarceration. More people get locked up in our country than anywhere else in the world. And yet we have illegal weapons that flow through our streets. And we have a lack of mental health support.
So there are really two statues here that are definitely, or they definitely deserve some criticism or at least some amendments. Now, the Safety Act in and of itself has a record of 94% of people who are released before trial do not reoffend. So Democrats will celebrate that, but the 6% do. And as you can see in this story, some of these situations turn into fatal outcomes. But that's not only the issue here. It's also the electric monitoring system, which you heard the Cook County State Attorney push back on and called it broken, because the numbers are in. It proves that statute in particular just does not work whatsoever. Take a look at this.
Originally, a way to reduce the prison population with nonviolent offenders, it has since taken on hundreds of violent offenders. 192 are charged with gun possession. That's up more than 200% since 2016. 115 charged with murder or attempted murder. That's up more than 600%. Also, more people out charged with sex crimes and vehicular hijacking. Critics say it also allows defendants to skip their court dates without consequence. Former Cook County Circuit Court Clerk Iris Martinez wrote a letter to Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle last fall claiming that two-thirds of all defendants on home monitoring did not show up for court.
How many times have I been telling you guys, the Democrats have a habit of applying policies that do the opposite of what they say the policy is supposed to do. Remember, at the national level, President Biden called it the what? The Inflation Reduction Act. What happened? Record inflation. The Safety Act. What happened? I don't know. A cop being killed, a woman being set on fire on the on the subway there. I mean, so many other countless murders, like a guy who buried his ex-girlfriend in the woods. I mean, there are more than just this story, folks. These are not one-offs. So again, it just goes to show that Democrats and their policies regarding public safety have a terrible track record. Let's go to our next update here, and we're going to stay on Democrats, because the meltdowns are continuing after the Supreme Court had ruled against the Voting Rights Act, which essentially is these congressional maps that were drawn based on race, because the idea is we need to protect minority voters. But at the same time, what happens if we discriminate against non-minority voters? So the Supreme Court had no choice but to throw that out, because the U.S. Constitution is supposed to be colorblind, right? Okay. Well, according to Democrats, they don't see it that way. Take a look.
Today's decision by this illegitimate Supreme Court majority strikes a blow against the Voting Rights Act and is designed to undermine the ability of communities of color all across this country to elect their candidate of choice. But we're not here to step back. We're here to fight back.
Yes.
Now, when this decision came out earlier today, it's an unacceptable decision, but not an unexpected decision. Because this isn't even really the Roberts Court. Mm-hmm. It's the Trump Court.
Yes.
And what we would expect from the Trump Court is an effort to continue their scheme to suppress the vote and rig the midterm elections and beyond. Because these extremists have failed America in every possible way. And now we're at a point where affirmative action is gone, diversity is gone, equity gone, inclusion gone, racial tolerance gone, the Voting Rights Act largely gone. But guess what, extremists? We're still here.
That's right.
And we're not going anywhere.
Guys, we're literally hearing politicians complain that they can't weaponize race anymore to win elections, to leverage policies, to affect change in our country that's unconstitutional. This is exactly what we're getting from the Democrat Party. I think this is a true mask off moment, especially for registered independents. If they need a reminder of how radical Democrats are, they're literally defending the very definition of discrimination, actually racial discrimination. Just imagine that. They believe that if we go to a neutral merit-based system, that minorities will not be represented. What I find to be interesting is there is a record number of Black people serving in Congress, more than any time in history. What more representation do you need? Okay.
Well, it's an interesting proposition you raise that they're not represented. My friend Patrick Ruffini sent out an interesting statistic tonight. There are 58 members of the House who are Black. It's a record, actually. A majority are actually elected from plurality white districts. We're so racist in America. You've got white people electing African Americans to Congress in record numbers.
Are those inherently people in the South? They are not in the South.
Well, Tim Scott is. As far as I know, Tim Scott is.
That's one. That's one example.
And so
that's not 58.
And so the issue is racism. It is inherently racist to draw lines and divide people up by race. I mean, the definition of it would be we're going to divide ourselves up by race and say only a Black congressman can represent Black people, only a Hispanic congressman can represent Hispanic people. That is patently illegal
under
U.S. law.
But the issue is they were trying to fix the problem.
And it also makes no sense when you consider that we're all Americans and we can vote for whoever we want.
The fact that they're trying to defend this is already a losing position. When you looked into the Louisiana case here, it was actually exposed in regards to what Jennings just said, that these white districts would actually vote for a Black candidate and the Black districts would not vote for the Black candidate. So which one is it exactly? And remember, Virginia had an opportunity to vote for a Black governor who was also a woman and they passed on her. Oh, yeah, that's right, because she was a Republican. See, they're morally bankrupt. They live in this world of hypocrisy and contradictions. They're not really consistent, and they're definitely not in alignment with the U.S. Constitution from the perspective of being colorblind. That's why this case did deserve to go to the Supreme Court. It made total sense.
And what you see Southern states openly talking about doing now is eliminating Black representation, disenfranchising African-American voters by drawing creative districts that completely take away any kind of representation. And so when you ask about the history, we all stand. I am here as a United States senator because of Americans of all backgrounds who joined together in a movement to end this kind of discrimination. And the Supreme Court, with the aid and abetting of Donald Trump, are now eviscerating those rights. And we're going to see, I think, us plunging back into a world where African Americans from many states again disappear from Congress.
Okay. I would love to debate these people who really believe in this nonsense, because the fact of the matter is, you think Black people are going to have a problem being represented? Have you seen the numbers regarding illegal immigration and what it's done to our population? White people will be minorities over the next 30 years. Book it. Okay. We've already seen what happened in Michigan. We're seeing what happened in New York City, and we're seeing what is happening across this country. You think Black people are going to have a problem being represented? No. White people, Black people, Asian people, people from India, they will definitely not be represented according to the way that they want things. It's just fascinating that he's going to lean on this idea of going back to Jim Crow, because that's what they do. They hope that they can relive that experience and make the American people feel that experience. But newsflash, we've moved on from that. This country is nowhere near the way it used to be, for good reason.
My view is that states ought to decide this. B, regarding John's argument, I just fundamentally think that the government shouldn't be in the business of dividing us up by race. It's fundamentally racist to divide us up by race. We have African-American members of the House winning in districts across the country with plurality white populations. We are well beyond the issues that were at play.
The issue there is Clarence Thomas.
We've obviously got some serious deficits. We haven't had an African-American Republican governor since Reconstruction. I mean, you know, there's a, unfortunately, imbalance in the two parties.
Republicans tried to elect one in Virginia.
Okay.
I'm just saying. And then you got a white Democrat who gerrymandered the state.
All right. I think, well, I think that sums it all up, right? Let's go to our next update. This is Chicago again. And this is just more damage to that society overall community. May Day is what they call it, where the Chicago public schools will be canceling school for one day and transporting students to protest against ICE and the Trump administration. Yes, you heard me correctly. Your public tax dollars, if you live in Chicago or Illinois, is going to this school system that is encouraging students to skip a day in order to engage in political activism, if that's what we want to call it, against the current administration. Who knew that is the new priority for students and their development? But only in America, I suppose. Let's hear more information on this. Take a look.
The Chicago Teachers Union also has its plan for the May 1st day of civic action all laid out. Workers, educators, and students plan to demonstrate Friday. CTU says they're demanding the rights of workers over billionaires, the abolition of ICE, funding for communities, not war, and free and fair elections. Now, this all starts at 8 a.m. Friday with school meetups. There are various demonstrations across the city leading up to the main rally at Union Park, which takes place at 1 in the afternoon, and then they will march to Daley Plaza at 2 p.m.
So here's my problem about this particular story, especially since they want to make everything about race. A public school district with 26% math proficiency and 40% chronic absenteeism is busing kids to a partisan rally while a $700 million deficit looms, and an inspector general just exposed $7.7 million in 2024 travel spending that was actually marked as fraud, $4,700 to in a Hawaii resort trip for one teacher. And then you're asking three-year-olds to make protest signs. What is going on here, folks? This is the problem within the community. They say they want more funding. They say they want better education, but they're doing the opposite of that. What they should be protesting is the people in charge.
Potentially hundreds of kids will be allowed to take a field trip to a May Day rally in Union Park during that school day. Last year's May Day rally in Union Park brought together thousands of people speaking out in opposition to the policies of the Trump administration. According to the agreement between Chicago Public Schools and the Chicago Teachers Union, CPS will provide buses for field trips of students and educators to attend the 1 p.m. May Day rally in Union Park this year.
Now, this story is a clear example of how teachers in America, in some locations like Chicago, they've turned into activists, political activists. That's more important than the development regarding the intellect of that child. Let me give you some facts that we can prove. Third through eighth grade, math proficiency sits at 26.2%. Chronic students who are absent, 40%. High schoolers are at 50%, meaning every 50% of students are not showing up. Travel spending, $3.6 million in 2019, the highest, $7.7 million in 2024. It's just absolute fraud. Let me show you an example of how these teachers have transformed from educators to political activists. Take a look.
What we're talking about in terms of May 1st is how do we collectively get our shit together and become more unified and solidaristic, because the world's looking at us. Just like the world was looking at King and Jesse on that bridge in 65. It was like one of the only things that was preventing Jim Crow from its reign of terror from continuing. Just like we are probably one of the only institutions in the country preventing an authoritarian regime from consolidating its power at the expense of our students, their families, unions, and workers across the country and across the world.
Now, think about the contradiction here. These are people who say they have a problem with our institutions in America, that our institutions are racist and they are not working in the best interests of American citizens and students. Then why is the teachers' union using the institution it controls, a public school district, to enforce political change? With the mayor, by the way, and the district contract as the enforcement mechanism, it makes no sense. That's why I continue to tell you guys, progressivism in America is a problem, because they want you to believe institutions are a problem, but they'll use these institutions to expand their power and also apply solutions that don't work. Again, there are no solutions here. There are only trade-offs when you're talking about governance. The trade-off here is we will rage against this administration, and in return, we won't focus on the root cause of our problems. One more example for you.
My name is Maria Huebner. I'm a first grade teacher at Fontana Elementary School. Palenque LSNA is planning a march and rally at the Logan Square Centennial Monument next Friday, May 1st at 10 a.m. We are organizing our school so that the K through 6 students are also going to be able to march. We're going to be doing sign making, art projects, maybe a banner build with the students.
I think I've said this a million times. This is not the same America as 50 years ago, even though Democrats want it to be. And also, when it comes to our public school system, if you're sending kids to public schools today, I mean, you're putting that child at great risk, especially regarding their intellect and well-being. It's really a disaster. In today's video, the California governor's race had a second debate last night, and it was an absolute dumpster fire. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass is facing a huge problem on her hands as a whistleblower has come out and exposed her for lying about the fires, and Hegseth testified on Capitol Hill today. But let's go to this debate, starting with Tom Steyer getting fact-checked by the moderator. Take a look.
What I said was that we should have the ability to outsource everything because we're under the thumb of the oil companies who have been jacking up prices. And if you look at the price of gasoline in the state of California, it is up because of the war in Iran. And that war has driven up prices for everybody in California by about $1.50. And the costs to the oil companies have not gone up a penny. That's $70 billion of profit to the oil companies because of a war started by Donald
Trump. So, Mr. Steyer, to be specific, the folks at home, you can go to cbsnews.com/CAGov and see what Mr. Steyer said. But you did, in fact, say that we should be outsourcing all refining.
We should be able to do that because if we're going to get held up by the few refineries left in California, it's going to be necessary for us to have an alternative.
Sir, I'm going to just go ahead and fact check a little bit here. So what happens is our gas supply is priced at the most expensive barrel. And right now, the most expensive barrel is coming in from overseas. And so gas prices in California are set at that level. Yes, refineries, yes, the oil companies are profiting more right now, but they're not the ones specifically, at least they say, they're not the ones specifically setting the price of gas. I'm not going to let other colleagues chime in. And actually, I would love to go to Ms. Porter.
Well, can
Porter,
I finish my
you.
Thought?
No,
because
sir, but
we
you can come back,
back
when it is your
windfall
time.
Windfall profits.
Sir, we're going to have to cut the mic if you're not respectful.
So needless to say, this debate for the next governor of California was a total dumpster fire for the Democrat candidates, that is. And I'll explain to you why. Just based on objective facts. I mean, two refineries by the name of Phillips 66 and Valero both closed and are moving out of the state, and they actually represented about 18% of the state's refining capacity. So what happens when you go from, let's just make the math simple, six refineries down to three, you outsource your gas from other countries overseas, you get high gas prices. And of course, these candidates can't admit that because it would contradict their whole statement and what they're running on. And guys, California is a great example. But when you allow radicals to run a state and they've run it into the ground, and I appreciate the moderators here because they were very fair, in my opinion. Let's go here.
Mr. Mahan, you brought this up. We're talking about gas prices. They're the highest in the nation here in California, and the gas tax is also the highest at around 61 cents per gallon. So this is that lightning round where you say yes or no, and then we'll get back to it later, but please give me a yes or no answer. Are you in favor of suspending the gas tax? We know that Mr. Mahan says yes. Javier Becerra says no. What do you say, Tony Thurmond?
Yes.
All right. Chad Bianco?
Yes.
Mr. Steyer?
I want a windfall profits tax on the oil companies who've raised the tax $1.50
All right, Mr. Steyer, that was a lot of no's there. Let's go to Mr. Hilton.
That
wasn't no. Mr. Hilton.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Ms. Porter.
No.
All right. Mr. Villaraigosa.
No.
So what you just heard there are Democrat candidates refusing to suspend 61 cents per gallon, because that's exactly what the gas tax represents.